This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right. Good evening, Dr. Lyle. How are you doing?
Good. Good to hear your voice.
Excellent. Good to have you on again. So, you know, this week we're talking about willpower and change. And I know that if listeners were to visit your website, esteemdynamics.org, they would see a lot of different audio clips and video clips and things with relation to evolutionary psychology. And a couple of the things that you have on there is about willpower. And I first heard about your take on willpower called the willpower paradox. This is through a health program, and you were kind of explaining why it is that people have such a difficult time to beat their genes with regards to health and food choices, and how it doesn't make any sense. It's quite a paradox that they might have plenty of willpower in one area of their life, but yet when it comes to food, they have quite a difficult time doing that. And so I'm looking forward to hearing you talk about a little bit about that, but also kind of in general about willpower and change.
Sure.
But before we talk about willpower and change, kind of the theme of the show has always been to beat your genes and to understand what our genes are trying to get us to do, and then try to see if that matches up with whether it's our long-term happiness or not. And if it is, mm-hmm. great. But if it's not, we have to learn how to outsmart our genes. And a lot of listeners have emailed me, and I know I've talked with some of my friends and family members who listen to the show, and the underlying argument tends to come up, the nature versus nurture argument, whether we are just born a certain way and things aren't going to change, and that's just how our nervous system is wired. And on the other hand, whether we are born a certain way and society crafts us, our friends craft us, our parents craft us in a particular mold, and we are the product of those experiences. And that's kind of the heart of a lot of the understanding of evolutionary psychology, is which one is which. And you've made some very, very compelling points that it's actually overwhelmingly nature. It's how we are built and how we are designed and how our nervous system is.
Yeah.
So this is interesting to me because there's a video right now going viral, and it's a video. It's a big jerk of a father who decides to scare his daughter. And he scares his daughter. She's sitting inside this convertible of his, and she wants to see the roof go up. And as the roof is going up and closing onto the car, he is mimicking his facial expressions and mimicking his voice as though she's getting eaten by a car. Now, of course, she's a young child, so she doesn't know any better. And she starts to believe that the car is actually going to eat her. So I want to listen in of the video that we have here.
It's gonna eat you.
Oh my god, Sophia! Oh my god! Oh my god! Oh my god, Sophia! Oh my god!
Now, the daughter is crying after this, and she eventually feels a little bit better, but, you know, for any normal person, this is not something fun to watch, a child just crying for no reason. And so, started looking at some of the comments in some of the pages where this is shared, and a lot of people were saying that, well, the dad has now scarred the child for life, and that she is going to have serious emotional issues for the rest of her life because of this. And while this is a very cruel thing to do to your own kid, or really to anybody, what say you, Dr. Lyle? Is this going to scar her for life?
Yeah, this is sort of unfortunate. It's actually quite unfortunate that the psychologists of the world are very uneducated in the architecture of the mind. And so a lot of the clinicians, social workers, counselors, et cetera, the academics wouldn't weigh in on this just because this is not their thing, and they would be smart enough to know that they wouldn't know in most cases. So if you're a perception psychologist, you actually would say that you wouldn't know. But believe me, all the clinicians in the world that are working with people, they're going to step right up, and they're going to have a cow about this as if this is a big deal. This is, of course, not a big deal. So let me explain why this is so. What traumatic experiences do is that they are essentially mechanisms. You have mechanisms to tell you, to calibrate for you, how traumatic a situation is. In other words, what was the extent of the possible loss and what were the circumstances? And so the mind's job is to actually engineer biological success. And so in this case, this little girl is now temporarily traumatized from being in that car, for God's sakes, because of this idiot father. Like, it's hard to believe that anybody would pull a stunt like this. I'll tell you who's traumatized is the guy's wife, and she'll never forget this. So that's the price this guy will pay behind this. The little girl has now had an experience of many experiences that she will have when she will be frightened, and there will be experiences that will be painful in her life. And painful and frightening experiences do not diminish your capacity for happiness at all, any more than if you slice your finger, when you're cutting an apple, it's going to hurt like the living daylights, and there's going to be a process of that healing up that's going to take a while, depending upon how bad the cut is. But if the cut does not do permanent damage to, because it's such an incredible trauma and doesn't slice its way through a nerve that can't repair itself, then we're going to be fine. And so you have many, many traumatic experiences physically in your life, and most of those have no lasting impact. A few of them might. And if it's bad enough, the experiences will be, could actually damage you physically. The mind is essentially very much equivalent to the body in this way. So, for example, let's suppose that you got sent over to Vietnam and you didn't have one terrifying experience like this little girl just had. You had hundreds of them, and it went on for months, okay? So now you have a situation where the mind had to be hypervigilant for months at a time and to become highly sensitized to sudden sounds and certain patterns of movement, certain conditions about where the person was relative to visual sight line, whether they were exposed or not exposed. And then they actually didn't hear or think or have it told to them that they were going to die. They actually saw death all around them. So this is an entirely different order of magnitude of trauma as to what this little girl is going through. So this little girl will have no memory of this thing within 3 years or less, and it will have absolutely no impact on her psychology as she goes forward in the future, any more than you have any impact on you for a skinned knee that you suffered on the playground at age 7, and then you got up crying about like she's crying because your knee was skinned up and it hurt and it was upsetting. And you cried a little bit, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, it's over. That is the architecture of the mind, and our friends in the social sciences, in the counseling side of the social sciences, are not aware of this. They don't understand that the mind is designed to engineer biological success in gene production. If you understand that, then you would never design an organism to be somehow terrified and compromised and have its ability to experience happiness and to be hyper-vigilant behind one short-term incident that didn't wind up with any bodily damage at all and therefore is of relatively small consequence in this organism's natural history.
Mm-hmm. And now, would we expect that this girl would have trouble 20 years down the line in maybe completing certain goals or exercising willpower in, say, her finances or her studying or her food intake?
Of course not. We have all kinds of people walking through. Here's one of my favorites. So there are people who lived through the Holocaust, and then there's people that lived through the Holocaust and then they told stories to other people. And so little kids, you know, in 1960, heard stories of their grandparents who lived through the Holocaust about how the Nazis knocked on the doors and how terrible it was. And it was terrible. So they're recounting their stories. Now, what's really entertaining for me is to hear people now saying, well, my grandfather told us these stories and I'm terrified. And it really changed my life. No, it didn't. It didn't change your life one iota. So here's what happened. You are capable of having a great many painful memories in your nervous system that have essentially no impact on your day-to-day functioning whatsoever. Those memories will be called up when the stimulus conditions are consistent with those memories. And by God, if it's secondhand memories, they're much weaker because your nervous system, you know, isn't really so sure that any of this really happened and this might have been such a bogus story. And so when you're a little kid, if you go to bed at night and your mom, your grandmother just told a horrible story of the Nazis, then while that is in your mind for a few nights or several nights even, you might think about that, you know, and you might listen to the door, the door knocks a little bit. It might cross your mind, oh, my God, I wonder if it's the Nazis. That is quite possible. But to think that that is having any appreciable impact on your nervous system as you continue in your life under stimulus conditions that have absolutely nothing to do with that is just the height of absurdity, and of course it has nothing to do with it. So this is why we find that trauma has almost essentially nothing to do with people's futures and how it is that they go about and live their lives. And the reason is that the traumas, the memories of the traumas and the impact on traumas are essentially little chips inside your head that say the following. If a situation comes up very much like this again in the future, if that happens, then I need you to experience some anxiety to try to avoid it and to organize an avoidance reaction in order to avoid the possible loss. That is how the system is constructed. So if the SS doesn't knock on your door, these things never get activated. Now, in pop psychology, the notion is that the mind is this sort of dumb recording device that actually works in hot wax. So if you have some terrible thing happen to you when you're three, it's embossed into the hot wax, and it biases the system and how it works for the rest of its life. That is a gross misunderstanding of the nature of how the brain works.
And so what does this have to do – well, actually, no. What does this have to do with willpower and change? Because I know in my practice I've heard certain stories from patients, and I know that I've talked to friends here and there. And something that keeps coming up is, well, when they do go on the topic of, you know, trying to change something or trying to accomplish a certain goal, or they can't keep finances straight or can't keep, you know, an exercise program or anything like that, it's that, oh, I don't really have a lot of willpower because, you know, I grew up in a really tense environment because my mom or dad were just really strict. And so I decided to rebel. And so I've never really, you know, whatever their explanation is, but it tends to
right.
look in the past.
Sure. So people are,
take us through,
people are,
take us through this.
Yeah. People are mystified as to why it is that they are having difficulties essentially getting themselves organized and have behavioral commitment to some kind of positive change. If we're going to try to understand change, we could talk about willpower, which we will. Willpower has more than one aspect to it that's interesting. There is a specific aspect we'll talk about a little bit later that's a very interesting discovery by Roy Baumeister and others. Having to do with sugar in the brain, so that's a short-term phenomenon that's quite interesting that we'll talk about in a little bit. But more importantly, when it comes to the more general concept of the determination and follow-through on making any sort of change, what we're going to do is we're going to try to understand the whole process of change from a brass tacks perspective, where we really understand the mechanics of how change takes place. So in order to understand change, we're going to have to understand why there's behavior as it exists in the first place. And the reason why there's a given behavior that is repetitive or a behavior pattern of an individual or an animal in the first place is simply because the mind is running cost-benefit analyses on the situation, and it's arriving at what it believes is the most efficient behavioral strategy in order to achieve the ends of optimal survival and reproductive goals. So that's what a brain is this. It's a device that computes probabilities in order to arrive at biological optimum behavioral strategies. So when you see that Joe always goes down to Taco Bell and gets a couple of tacos and comes home after work, you're saying, oh, I wonder why he does that. The answer is that his brain has computed a cost-benefit analysis on all of the alternative strategies that it can consider. So it can't consider going to a fresh French restaurant 6 miles away that it doesn't even know exists. So that does not get computed inside of his brain. What gets computed inside of his brain are the alternatives that he is aware of, the alternatives that he hypothesizes. He might hypothesize getting a hamburger at Hamburger Hamlet, but it might turn out that Hamburger Hamlet shut down last week and he doesn't know it. So he's considering that possibility, even though that possibility doesn't exist, but he perceives that it exists. So what individuals are doing is they're running a cost-benefit analysis on their estimation as to what the real situation is in reality, and their brain automatically arrives at the optimum for the ratio between effort and benefit. In other words, it runs a cost-benefit analysis and is simply a shopper, as it just in the way that you would shop for a set of new tires, and you pick up the phone and you call 5 or 6 places and you'd find out who sells those specific tires for the least. That's exactly what your mind is doing. Is it shopping through its alternatives and it's looking for the best ratio. You might not, for example, decide to go with the cheapest tire. Somebody may tell you, oh, well, for just $5 more, we can get you a substantially better tire that will last 20% longer, and therefore it's cost-effective. Since it's got a better ratio with respect to energy expended, you might then buy the more expensive tire because you felt like it was a better value. So what the nervous system is doing is it's computing values, and what values are is they are simply situations or interactions that the living entity has with things outside of it, and those things outside of it are potential targets for interaction, for the exchange of molecules or energy. And as a result of that, as a result of those exchanges, there is a potential increase in the statistical likelihood of the gene survival of the organism. So if it's a young guy trying to hit on a young girl, then she is a stimulus entity, is housing some eggs that his nervous system wants to get to through sexual activity that would then, if he were to do that it would increase the statistical likelihood of his genes surviving. So this is actually what's happening inside of brains, and it doesn't matter if the brain that we're talking about is an aardvark or a Tyrannosaurus rex or a bowerbird or a human. It's all the same process. And it's going to turn out that there's going to be two major sources of data as well as a computational system that is going to determine what it is that this organism is going to do. So what it has a universal value system that's already pre-computed at birth, that it's already preset. So for example, suppose that you had a worm living in a primordial swamp, and this thing has the ability to detect temperature. So it can detect, if it gets below 80 degrees, it's too cold and it's going to freeze. Gets above 90, it's too hot and it's going to fry. So this thing has a preference for being in the middle. And so that would be a computational input that this thing gets sensory information in, and it is essentially now is informed about a variance in the environment. And by having information on this thing, and if that information is associated with an increased or decreased likelihood of gene survival, then it values a good temperature and it disvalues bad temperature. So but it's not that simple. So then I want you to think of this same organism as that it can also smell food. So it can feel temperature and it can smell food. So it may turn out that it's getting very hungry and it's staying where it's comfortable for it, but it can smell that there's food over to the left, and over to the left it can also detect that it's getting too cold. So what this thing has to do is it has to compute whether or not it's worth going into the cold in order to get the food. And it must be able to run that computation accurately in order to arrive at an optimal behavioral strategy. So when we start, it gets much more complicated. We can now add that it can hear a predator, and then we're going to all see that it can see a mate. So it can see a mate, hear a predator, it can smell food, and it can feel temperature. When we start getting in different sensory inputs, those sensory inputs all can be informing it in a different way about variances in the environment that are associated with its survival and reproductive chances. And then the job of the brain is to run a mathematical calculation that will arrive at the optimal solution. And that's what that organism does. And it doesn't matter if it's an aardvark or a Tyrannosaurus rex or a beetle, okay, or a human. It is all doing the same thing. A more complicated organism is simply an organism that runs more possible contingencies. It has more and different sensory inputs. The sensory inputs are richer in terms of the amount of data that it's bringing in about the environmental variance. And something else winds up being extremely important, and that is if you have an organism with a very big brain, what you can do is you can actually record data from the past. And so what you have is a memory system. And so with a memory system, what happens is that you can vastly improve the accuracy of the organism in order to run the optimal calculations. So, for example, if you're a rabbit and you're thinking about getting food and you go out there and you can smell the food, you can't hear a predator, but you know that at about this time of day, about 3 p.m., there's always a fox that seems to be coming by this area at about that time. Then if you have a memory system, even if you don't have sensory data about the fox, you have sensory data about a variance that is associated with the fox. So you run a correlation coefficient on the time of day along with the likelihood of the fox arriving, and you wind up altering your behavior in a way that is not actually organized by the innate system. So it is the innate system is the relationship between how far the fox is away and how far the food is away. That's a fixed mechanism that resides inside the system. But the fixed mechanism is very flexible, because what happens is if it has a memory system, that memory system then runs correlates as to environmental variables that are associated with variables that are already computed and prefixed relative to each other inside the system. And this now makes this organism extremely flexible in its behavior. Okay? So what motivation is simply the organism is bringing in information with its sensory environment. It's computing that against variances in its memory as well as the direct inputs to the sensory environment. It now computes a whole bunch of possible behavioral alternatives depending upon how creative and flexible this particular organism is and how ingenious its mind is about coming up with all alternative possible behavior patterns as it tries to work the calculus as to what is the best solution for the problem of what's the next best move that I can make for survival and reproductive success. That is how this thing works. So if we're looking at change, it's going to turn out that there's going to be two avenues of change in the system. We are not going to change the underlying fixed universal value system. And when I say that it's fixed, let me explain that if this organism can smell food in the cold water and it can detect that if it goes towards that food, there's a 90% chance that it's going to die by the time it would get the food and get back to the warm water, and yet there's a 100% chance that it's going to die if it doesn't get some food, then it will take that chance, okay? It's going to run those mathematical estimates. That's in fact what a brain is. It's a mathematical estimator of gene reproduction statistics. And so so it's going to turn out that system you're not going to change. Given X amount of threat to my survival by food deprivation versus X amount, Y amount of survival as a result of freezing, the system knows how to calibrate the relative intensity of those sensory inputs and to come up with the solution that has been the solution that the genes encoded because that those were successful. So that is a fixed value system that you are born with and that we're not going to modify. However, it's going to turn out that there's going to be two primary ways that you're going to watch the change of behavior patterns. And that's going to be, number one, if the environment changes. So you're going to watch people change their behavior patterns if the environment changes. So Joe goes down to the sandwich shop and always gets the same sandwich, but then they close the sandwich shop, and he's been going there for 14 years. Well, now we're going to observe that his behavior changes. So he's not going to do the same thing as he did before. He has to now run the computations on the existing data now and come up with a new solution. So it's going to turn out that one of the most effective ways to change people's behavior is actually to change the structure of their environment. That winds up being a very effective way to get things done. Now, there's a second way that behavior gets changed, and that is that the information changes inside the brain. So so it's going to turn out, for example, that you thought that you were safe going 60 miles an hour on a road that had some wetness. And then one day, you, in swerving to miss a rabbit, you slide very out of control on a slightly wet road and going 60 miles an hour, and you survive. But now you've now got new information inside your brain. Your brain now says, you know what, I'm not as safe as I thought I was. I had overestimated my ability to manage the car at 60 miles an hour with the road wet. And so now the nervous system is altered, okay? So it is through new information or a change in environment, which is also new information, is how it is that behavior gets changed. So psychologists are notoriously frustrated with the fact that people do not change their behavior. There's the old joke about, you know, how many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb? Answer, one, but the light bulb has to want to change. You know what I mean? This is these sort of frustration. Because psychologists are very often frustrated that their clients don't change their behavior. And the reason they don't change their behavior is because they don't get any new compelling information that alters their cost-benefit analysis that a new behavioral pattern would be more effective. Okay? This is why they don't change. And so if you're trying to figure out why you keep doing something over and over again, and even though you suspect that it might be a more optimal behavior pattern to do X, but instead you continue to do Y, the answer you continue to do Y is because the stimulus environment and the information in your head, you essentially are continuing to come up with the same equation. You run the same math and you wind up with the same solution. And the cost-benefit analysis says, we were, as far as we know, this is the right solution. Okay? So that is why human behavior is so consistent over time, is because the people will continue to run. Essentially, what they do is they optimize their life's behavior according to the ecological constraints and their understanding of the ecological constraints. In other words, it's not only the ecological constraints that you can see; it's also what you can't see. So that rabbit may be almost starving to death, and he may decide that he cannot risk going out into the meadow because this is the time of the day that the damn fox comes every day. And that fox has been out there every day for the last 27 days, but it turns out, unbeknownst to the rabbit, that the fox got killed last night. So now that rabbit may literally starve to death, even though there was, even though he would have been safe. And so what you think is true versus what is true is almost always two different things. So your brain is only an estimate. That what you believe to be true about reality is only an estimate about what is true. It's a guess, okay? Smarter, better informed people are more accurate about what reality really is, and they make less mistakes, all right? So that's why smarter people have less antioxidants. They have less bad drug interactions that kill them. They fall off of buildings less. Why? Because their brains are actually analyzing risk rewards more effectively and they make less mistakes. Okay? In fact, the entire concept of, quote, smart is the notion that there is additional information that is accurate and therefore aiding the reduction of error. That's what a smartphone is. That's what, you know, smart bombs are. This is all about the reduction of error. Okay, so the change happens when people get new information that makes them believe that their old vision of how reality works is incorrect. And so as a result, they really don't have any choice. When you get information that is very compelling, i.e. compelling meaning that the reasoning mechanisms that you are born with inside your head that understand how reality works, that reality doesn't have contradictions in it. So it has apparent contradictions, but it doesn't have any real contradictions in it. Anybody that's a mystic that doesn't believe that we actually know the forces of the universe is a hypocrite every time you step on an airplane. Because obviously that's an incredible thing that is happening, that you can go up in the air 37,000 feet, fly to Rome and be safe and expect overwhelmingly to get there without any problem. How does that happen? Because it turns out that an awful lot of people know, you know, an awful lot about physics, and it has been worked out and we know that things work in a certain way. Your brain absolutely can figure this out. And it can figure out all kinds of things, and it has beautiful logical mechanisms that are built into it. Very smart brains can work on very smart, very complex problems. Brains that aren't so smart, that are human brains, can reason very well about problems that are less complex, and they will come up with their understanding about how life works, and then from there they will run their cost benefit analysis and they live their life. Now, if we're going to try to figure out, you know, what it's going to take to actually shift their behavior out of something that we believe is not in their best interest, it's going to take compelling evidence. It's going to take figuring out what it is that they think and why it is that they think that, and then we're going to have to engage them in a reasoning process where we present them with evidence that they see, in fact, that what they believe to be true is not true, okay? And if they come to believe something new and different, whether it's right or wrong, if they come to believe something different, they will shift their behavior in the direction of what it is that they think to be true, okay, and with new information in order to optimize their cost-benefit analysis. So in the final analysis, the most effective therapy is nothing other than education, and what that education is the most insightful education about the nature of the problem that the person is facing, why it is that they are unhappy and frustrated, okay? There's reasons why they are unhappy and frustrated, and that is because they have self-calibrating mechanisms that actually inform them about how effective they should be in one of the three major pursuits of life, which is mating, friendship, or trade. And so they are self-calibrated by their interaction with the world as they observe others and they observe the talents and trading resources of other people in these domains. And then they calibrate themselves in these same domains. And if it turns out that their feedback is below what it is that they expect, then they are frustrated and depressed about this. If their feedback is about right, they are fine. If their feedback is better than they think it should be, they are quietly elated and a little bit paranoid that they're going to lose it. Okay, so this is sort of how the nervous system works. So if you think about this, what you have is you have very sophisticated self-calibrating equipment that tells you how well you should be doing at something. This is like, for example, somebody that needs to get a B in chemistry to finish their major and maybe go to grad school or something. So they're working on their B in chemistry, and they are about a B student in this type of class. So when they work very hard and they get a B, all is fine with the world. If they work very hard and they get an A, they are ecstatic. If they work very hard and they get a D, they're depressed. Okay? So in other words, it all has to do with their self-calibration. If they're an A student and expect an A, and they work really hard and they get a C, they're devastated. If they're a D student and they work really hard and they get a B, they're elated. So how it is that a person feels all depends upon how successful am I being relative to what my self-calibration is. the process of trying to have goals and change is the notion that I expect that if I put my energies in, I can get an improvement in performance in one of these three areas, and that so this is what a goal is. And when someone is frustrated or unhappy about something, it's because they are surprised and confused about the degree of the negative feedback, and they don't understand it, okay? And so this is an example then we could wander into is someone who is overweight and they are seemingly not changing their diet. And so the therapist that they're talking to, of course, everybody is in such consternation as they're trying to figure out why this person, you know, can't lose weight. And so what do we get? We go to the shrink, and the shrink tells you it's because, you know, your interactions with your harsh father caused you to be fixated at the oral stage of development, and now you have a repetitive pattern in dealing with anxiety with authority figures. So this real problem is because of your boss or your husband. Okay. This is the sort of fantasy that gets spun out in the world. Now, this is untrue, okay? And all the talking in the world about the underlying dynamics between them and their father is not going to change this person's behavior pattern. Not going to happen. This person's behavior pattern is taking place. They're making the food and lifestyle choices they're making based on a cost-benefit analysis that their mind is running on the situation that they're in. Number one, what they believe to be true, and number two, what the sensory input is into the nervous system. So it is no mystery why people are overweight. They're overweight because the sensory evidence tells them if they eat richer food, there's more calories in it, and therefore it increases their likelihood of survival. And if they eat food with less calories in it relative to the richer food, it tells them that they're making a mistake. Okay? So it's very simple that the nervous system has a fairly unsophisticated chip in it that says eat really rich food relative to food that is less rich. And by rich, I mean the caloric density of the food. Essentially, what the taste bud and olfactory system are is they're essentially like a metal detector for somebody who's trying to find gold. And so as a result of this, the nervous system says eat the richest food that you can get that's available. And in that case, what that person is doing is they're eating the rich food, and now that food is inconsistent with the natural history of the species, that the food is far too rich, and now the person's overweight. And so the person remains overweight. And so they are systematically overeating as a result of the fact that their nervous system is running a cost-benefit analysis on their food choices in exactly the way it was designed by nature to run. And it just so happens you've got a change in the environment that the system was not designed for. So the person inexorably makes a mistake. Now, what do we do about this? Well, they're going to look for help because it's going to turn out that they are less attractive, less healthy. People think less of them in essentially all possible trade situations. They're less attractive sexually. They're less attractive as friends, and they're less attractive as trading partners. This is the brutal reality of that situation. So as a result of that, they're highly motivated to do something about it. So they go to the shrink, and of course that fails. And then they read one of the 75,000 different diet books that's been published on the subject. And it turns out that everybody's got a story to tell, and the vast majority of those stories are going to be bogus. And the reason why the stories are going to be bogus is because that the people that are selling the books are motivated to sell books. They're not motivated particularly to tell the truth. So we've got an interesting problem, cost-benefit analysis if you're a diet author. It behooves you to tell people what they want to hear rather than what they need to know. And so as a result, there's tremendous misinformation in this world about, in this entire arena, about what people should be doing about it. But even if they find the truth, which is the fact that the processed foods have removed all the natural fiber from the food, and therefore the food is now artificially concentrated, and because the food is artificially concentrated, it requires more of it to activate the sensory mechanisms in the stomach in order to signal the hypothalamus that you've had enough to eat. Okay, it's really basically pretty simple. So as a result of that, all the foods have now, of course, been hyper-concentrated by removing the fiber of the food, and the reason why they would do that is because it makes the food much, much tastier, because the food is now more calorically dense and therefore appears to be more valuable for survival to an organism that was designed for an environment of caloric scarcity. So as you have that problem, this person now, if they're sitting in my office, I'm going to explain to them that their nervous system is lying to them and it doesn't know it. That in fact, they have to eat food of less caloric density rather than greater caloric density. And the foods that they have to eat are going to be foods that are consistent with the natural history of the organism, at which point this mechanisms of satiation will work accordingly as the way that they're supposed to, so the person will neither overeat nor undereat. And they will be just like any of the other tens of thousands of species on the planet that do not have to monitor their food intake in order to be optimally healthy. So the problem is that this person now lives in an environment where the sensory evidence keeps telling that brain, the basic neural structure of the brain, that if you eat the food of less calorie density, you're doing the wrong thing. So now we arrive at the issue of willpower. Okay, willpower is effectively the problem where a very sophisticated organism like a human can realize that there's more than one possible pathway that it could take here, and it's computing out the two different courses of action, and it's trying to figure out which is the right one. And the problem is that one of them is much more compelling for short-term goals, and one of them is much more compelling for long-term goals. And so there's a conflict between those two. And so if you knew that you were going to die in 3 days and you had a choice to eat a head of lettuce or a Snickers bar, the rational thing to do would be the Snickers bar, because it would be dinging the mechanisms of rich food much more heavily. It would be much more pleasurable, and there would be absolutely no reason to worry about the long-term consequences of the Snickers bar. So the sort of more primitive computation is to say, we'll go for the short-term and optimize it. However, if it turned out that we had no such threat to our survival in the long term, and that we were going to live with the consequences of eating Snickers bars instead of salads, and that was going to make us substantially less sexually attractive, substantially less attractive just generally as a human being, and that there would be economic and social costs that would be substantial. If we were designed to actually compute those costs naturally, it would be an easy program to simply do the long-term best thing. But here's the problem, Nate. There are certain problems for which we were not designed to compute those long-term costs very effectively. And that's because the issue of eating too rich of calories and winding up with these social consequences is not a natural contingency that human beings were designed to compute, because it didn't exist. So this is a novel problem for the brain, and it's going to turn out that when the brain has novel problems, where it has a very compelling answer to what the question is in its environment between, for example, less concentrated food and more concentrated food, if it already has a compelling answer that says you should go for the more concentrated food, it is unbelievably difficult for the organism to actually override that with education. Okay? It can be done, and it is being done, and it's been done by many people, but it doesn't come easily, and it actually takes pretty profound, deep education on most people's part to understand that that's what it is that they need to do. And then we're going to get to the next part of what will sustain behavior change. So behavior change is going to take place when we get new information that changes our understanding about the way the world works and us in it, and for important issues for ourselves, and therefore alters the cost-benefit analysis that the brain comes up with, and then the person will change. Okay, so there's no magic little genie in there that decides that you're either going to do something or not do it, or this is going to be the day. No, what there is, in fact, is tremendous networks of cost-benefit analytics that are churning through, and as we learn more about an issue, where particularly where we may be failing, we may come upon information that is compelling in some way, and that will cause us to do it. So I've seen many people, for example, that will go on the Atkins diet. And the reason they'll go on the Atkins diet is they had a friend that did it and they lost weight. So they saw that and they said, okay, that works. So I'm going to try that. And not only that, when they go on the Atkins diet, they can eat a bunch of rich food, surprisingly. And so the Atkins diet is kind of a tricky process. It's not healthy in my judgment at all, but it's sort of a biological trick. And as a result of that, people can lose weight, and now they are motivated to continue. Because as you get feedback from a behavior change, if you change your behavioral strategy and it actually improves, then you are, quote, motivated to continue. Because why? Because it's just running cost-benefit analysis. Okay? If you go to a new sandwich shop, and even though you've been going to the old one, you happen to wander into the new one day on your visit to the shoe store, and you go to the new sandwich shop, and it's better and cheaper than your old sandwich shop, and it's no further from your house, you will shift your behavior. Okay? So this is the message, that there is no magic to change and no magic to willpower per se. What's really happening here is that the mind is shifting its analysis either on based on a change of your environmental inputs or a changing of your understanding of the environment that you can't see, including, for example, you may learn that scientists have shown that high amounts of animal food in humans will reliably result in cardiovascular disease. And since you saw your three brothers and your sister and your aunt and uncle and your father and your mother die of cardiovascular disease by the time they were 55, and it turns out that you're 52, that may get your attention, or it may not get somebody else's attention. Okay, so as you learn more about what you think the case is, this will now infect the cost-benefit analytics of your mind, and you will shift. Okay, so if we're trying to figure out why people change, what they change behind is new information. So you'll hear all kinds of people talking about, for example, oh, well, you'll change with experiences. Well, it isn't experiences that change you, it's the information, okay? So that information could be in a book, it could be a friend telling you something, it could be simply you analyzing a situation and then coming up with what you believe to be a theory about how you think something works, or it could have been an experience. There's a multitude of ways that the mind brings in data and grinds and then tries to find a solution to a problem. And remember, the things that it's usually working on are when there's a discrepancy between the performance, the feedback that you're getting, versus what your self-calibration believes you should be getting. Those are the problems that the human mind is generally constantly grinding on, that frustrate it, that motivate it to seek new information. Okay? So it is the seeking of new information that is, in fact, the roots of change. And so now we can get to a prescription for positive change in your life, almost with respect to any possible goal that you can imagine. And the motivational force that will be lit, it'll be lit automatically when you come upon new information where there's somebody knows something about a problem that you are working on, and they know more than you know, and they can essentially disillusion you about something that you thought was true. It was actually the root of your frustration, of the discrepancy between your performance feedback and what you thought was coming to you by virtue of your essentially standing in that competitive arena. So when someone knows something that you didn't know, then that will change you. So we seek out experts. We seek out.
That's how the show was made.
Okay. You can sort of see how people know this intuitively. So they are often very much more interested, for example, in some beauty queens telling us about how to be beautiful than we might be in a scientist who has studied beauty that looks like a nerd. Okay, and yet we would be making a mistake. So it's useful. You know, the Stone Age brain says, imitate success. So let's go talk to Cindy Crawford and find about how she keeps her face pretty. Okay, that's a nice guess, and it's a hell of a lot better than nothing, but there are better guesses in the world, and the better guesses in the world are, let me find out who's at Harvard who has studied the problems of, you know, I don't know, skin elasticity and diet and exercise and whatever else, you know, additives that one uses in soap that actually helps the skin, okay? We're much more interested in that guy, even though if he looks like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. I'm really interested in what he has to say and his evidence, and I'm not so interested in Cindy, but I will watch her commercial, okay? But this is part of beating your genes is to understand how your genes are built in terms of trying to learn things, and to recognize that sometimes those learning mechanisms, although they were the best ones that we had in our natural history, they're not actually optimal for today. So one of the useful things to understand is that science, as polluted and chaotic as it can be, is generally, you know, the place that we want to look, and we try to want to find whether or not there's a toehold. If people have studied elements of the problem, sometimes they haven't. Sometimes the best thing that we can do is to go to experts in the field who have had a lot of success at, for example, coaching other people out of these problems. So we don't go to Cindy, okay? We go to somebody who runs a salon that is, you know, that is very effective and popular. That would be a better place to go to find out about what you put on your face.
Yeah, and this is also why it seems like a lot of people will listen to somebody who is genetically gifted. They've got a nice body. They've got, you know, big muscles or well-defined abs, and so they're selling, like, you know, the latest shoes or the latest protein
sure.
powder or the latest, you know, hiking equipment or whatever. And it's that's why people will listen to them.
Yes, this is all imitative function. So obviously, success leaves clues, and people are going to, particularly when very gifted people, of course, can be disingenuous. Basically, and they always are, about, oh, yeah, you know, essentially I put on this cologne and I turn into Catherine Deneuve. You know what I mean? it's like, okay. But the point is that they will tell their story about how it is that they were failing until they got, you know, this balm from Malaysia, and then they put that on, and then the whole thing changed for them. So you know, I went to a Tony Robbins thing, and I walked across the coals, and then I realized that there was a giant within me, and now I'm the head of a Fortune 500 company. this is the sort of snake oil that, of course, is going to be sold, and it's when brains are gullible and looking for shortcuts, which they relentlessly do. A lot of money changes hands to people who are clever about duping people about what the real factors are in success.
Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is that there really isn't a magic pill, potion, powder, supplement, or sentence, or, you know, or process that's going to change people's lives or change their course of their lives. It's a lot of hard work, and a lot of what you're saying is there's no magic here. We have to change our environment before we start to change ourselves, because we really can't change our nervous systems. We can't change ourselves.
Yeah, there's other things that we have to do, particularly in essentially what there are, almost any pursuit, that any goal or anything that you have ever wanted to change about yourself and your existence, other people have done it. They are competing. You already have your act or your strategy in a given domain, in the romance domain, friendship domain, and in the domain of commerce. You already have a strategy that you're playing, and if it's not working very well, you're already motivated to try to figure out what little permutations can you do on this thing that would improve it. And if you're stuck, you just don't know. You can't come up with something that is more compelling. So the thing to do is to start looking for answers. And the best place to look is for people who are successful in coaching people through that problem. And people that are successful in coaching people through that problem are not mysterious. People that are truly successful have identified what I'm going to call the rudiments. There's the rudiments to being a great drummer. There's the rudiments to being a great guitar player. There's the rudiments to being a great basketball player. There are the rudiments to being a good psychologist. There are the rudiments to being a good chiropractor. There are the rudiments to being a good small business person, you know, with a door-to-door sales campaign. There are fundamentals, okay? And we need to know what the fundamentals are, and we need to get better at executing the fundamentals, because there's no magic to being Michael Jordan. What there is that there's a tremendous amount of effort in getting extremely competent at the fundamentals. And when you see a magnificent performance, what you're really seeing is the execution of a stream of fundamentals. And it looks very creative and elegant, and it may be, but the truth is, within that creativity, all you see is the execution of fundamentals. Whether we're looking at a Michelangelo statue or we're talking about Michael Jordan on a basketball court or anything else where you see human beings attempting to execute a strategy on anything to accomplish a goal, what you are watching is you are watching the execution of fundamentals. And so people can almost always get better at the fundamentals. But that selling the fundamentals is generally not going to make for good stories, and it's not going to make for bestsellers, and it's not going to make for, you know, some kind of fancy snake oil that's going to do this quickly. Usually the competitive problems that you are facing and the reason why you are struggling in a given domain is not because you are missing some magic element that somebody can tap on your head. It's usually that you are missing the information and effort involved in executing some fundamental in a stream of fundamentals that is necessary. You need to do that. You need to have an expert tell you, perhaps, what that fundamental is that you're missing. You need to then work and improve it, and then your performance will improve, and then you will wind up with better feedback, and then you will wind up out of the unhappiness that was there to signal you that all along you thought you could have gotten more, and it turned out you were right.
Wow. Can you tell us the story? I remember you hearing telling us about John Wooden and how he made his teammates, you know, put on the measure their shoes and measure their socks and et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, the famous story was that a group of recruits was sitting down for the first day of practice at UCLA when John Wooden came out to greet them, and one of them, I think it was Bill Walton, was waiting for what the great sage would say that was going to motivate them and to carry them to the championship. And he expected this sort of rah-rah sort of speech about this great season that they were going to have. And instead, what he said was he wanted them to put on their socks, and he wanted to see it. And he went around from kid to kid and made sure that their socks were on properly. He measured their feet, and he made sure that their shoes fit their feet properly. And then he explained to them that the reason why they did that is because if their shoes and socks did not fit properly, then when they practiced, they would get blisters. And if they got blisters, then they couldn't practice as effectively. If they didn't practice as effectively, they wouldn't play as effectively in the game. And if they didn't play as effectively in the game, that the team wouldn't reach their potential. So it begins here with making sure that you've got the right shoes on your feet and that you know how to put on your socks properly. This was a beautiful demonstration of Wooden's overall philosophy, that the notion is we don't look at failure as failure. We look at it as evidence that there is a place to look at our fundamentals where we probably need to give those more attention. And if we work harder on the fundamentals, our performance will improve. And as Wooden said, then we will be happy with the result. To John Wooden, the notion was it isn't about winning. It's about a peace of mind. That success is a peace of mind of knowing that you have done what you could to reach your potential. You are not designed to only be happy if you are a, quote, winner. You're designed to be happy if you are clear that you have received the feedback from the world that is reasonable given your native talents. So a person who is not that smart, not that good-looking, not that fancy, but if that person does an excellent job of actualizing their potential, they can be just as happy as the fanciest guy in the world, okay? Because their feedback will make sense to them, and their internal feedback from their self-esteem mechanism will feel very solid about who it is that they are and what they've accomplished.
Fantastic. Are there any closing points you want to make about willpower and change?
No, we forgot about Baumeister, but that's all right. That's enough for one.
Yeah,
minute.
We can talk about Roy Baumeister's excellent book next one of the shows following this one. So, Dr. Lyle, thank you very much. What a wonderful explanation about willpower change. You know, I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, man, this is a missing link for me in a lot of the stuff that I've been trying to change in my own personal life. So I really appreciate mm-hmm. that. That's amazing.
Absolutely, that's what we're here for, and I hope some people benefit. That's great, Nate.
Absolutely. Well, have a wonderful night, and we'll look forward to speaking with you next week.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.